and welcome to this episode of the Newcastle Oral History Unit podcast. Throughout this series, we'll broadcast regular episodes that feature some of the fantastic interviews we've conducted in the last couple of years. Episodes will range from project-specific discussions to conversations with leading international oral historians about their own practice and future directions of the field. Please feel free to contact us at any time via email, where we're oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk, or follow us on Twitter, where we're at @NCL_oralhistory. My name's Alison Atkinson-Phillips, and this episode comes from a roundtable conversation we had with oral historian and filmmaker Steve Humphreys. Steve is the founder and executive producer of Testimonies Films. He's produced over 100 television programs for international and national broadcasters, including Hull's Headscarf Heroes and Love Child, the heartrending story of adoption in Britain. The voices you'll hear are Steve, myself, Sue Bradley, Andy Clark, and Graham Smith. The episode begins with Steve talking passionately about the benefits of using video to conduct oral history interviews rather than audio alone. He also shares some of his top tips for intimate interviewing. I hope you enjoy.
The film aspect of it is so much better for all the kind of reasons we know. We live in a video-led world where on the internet, YouTube, you want to see the faces of the people. That's where you can look into the soul of them when they're telling their moving story. You can also illustrate it with photographs and archive film. It brings it to life. Most people want to watch pictures as well as sound. The audiences for radio are minute compared to television in all its forms, or video history in all its forms. And I think it's a betrayal of the people that are alive today not to see them as they are and just have their voices, their disembodied voices. They've got, it's far less value in the future. People will look back and think, why didn't you actually film them? Why just record the sound of them?
Is there a difference in terms of audio and film, though, in terms of the impact on the interview itself?
It's impactfulness, yeah.
I don't mean it's impactful, but actually impacts on the person you're interviewing. Because that's one of the arguments, isn't it?
Against video history.
Yeah, yeah.
I've never really understood that argument. I think there's a problem in terms of video histories sometimes with community groups, because they're not very experienced at using the equipment. It adds another layer of complication. I've never found that older people, most of the people I've filmed have been older, that they've got a problem with being filmed. They actually quite like it. They want to see themselves back. It's kind of a taboo that I've never come across. Nobody has ever said, oh, I'm happy for you to record the sound, but I really don't want to be seen in this. They're really proud, I think, to see themselves back on television. They want copies of the programme to keep for the family. And I don't think it phases them being on camera, but you've got to do it properly. And I've got this kind of 20 rules of intimate interviewing, which I wrote some time ago. I can tell you some of the most important ones that anybody could practice, which is, first of all, you've got to get the person to trust you and you've got to befriend them very, very quickly when you go in so that they're not frightened. And the big mistake that most directors make is they leave the interviewee cold. They fuss about the lighting, the layout, what positions they're going to be in, and that person is really, really scared. That's rule number one of doing an intimate interview with someone, is to get them to trust you and like you immediately. Well, I'll tell you, the others very, very quickly are, you've got to sit close to them. You've got to make really good eye contact with them constantly. Loads of people don't do these most basic things. And they've got to be telling you the story for the first time. So I always get somebody else to research it a bit so it's genuinely the first time, so it's spontaneous. That is one of the most important things of all. And my most important question that I ask over and over again, which encourages an intimate response, I learnt this off my mum. I hadn't realised it at the time. My mum died when she was very young. But everyone used to tell her their story. And her key question that she would always say to them was, how did you feel about that? That is my most used question, because it encourages an intimate emotional feeling response rather than a factual one. Those are the bits that we use most of all on telly, is the response to how did you feel about that, because you're often, the bits that you use will be 20 to 30 seconds long. You can set up the background in commentary. That's the bit where you want to see them in vision. I think oral historians could up their game, actually. There are such simple rules. And I think not knowing the rules has inhibited oral historians from doing video histories, which I think are a step forward in so many ways from just the audios. It's kind of the transaction between interviewee and interviewer has been mystified a bit and made more problematical than it needs to be. I think following some simple rules could improve that. I think most people really welcome somebody coming in and asking them informed and sensitive questions about themselves and their lives. It's a bit of a cliche, but people do like to talk about themselves. And if they've had an interesting life, they really want to, and they really want to feel that their life is going to be preserved in some way. It's a human connection is the important thing. You're telling it to somebody that you trust and like. That's the whole point of it. That's what we work up towards, you know. The researcher meets them, they think we're nice and they can trust us, and then I meet them and I try and form this very intense relationship in a very short time. We do often darken the room a bit to create a moody atmosphere. So we get rid of available light, and it's almost like a confessional. We have a light on them, and so they can't see the rest of the room. All they can see is me. And I'm like the sympathetic listener, very, very close to them. And it works, usually. Doesn't work all the time. I mean, but nobody protests. No one says this is terrible. It works in the sense that you get really moving, intimate testimony, as we hope to. Another thing that I do, the very, very best bits, I think, of oral history, and when I can see it on television, are when someone is telling you their intimate story and then they've got to a key bit and they pause. And what interviewers do wrong, I think, is they come in too quickly with the next question. If you leave it for 3, 4, or 5 seconds, the very best bits of testimony and testimony on television are when they add to it. They're looking at you, they've thought about it, maybe there's a tear in their eye, and then they carry on. That is amazing when that happens. I'm always looking to get some moments like that, if I can, in a film. People often get frightened if someone's a bit emotional. But at the end of almost all the interviews that you do where people get emotional, they've actually found it a great release, and they thank you for it, unbelievably. I mean, I don't want to be thanked for it, but they do, because they had an opportunity to tell something that they haven't told often to their family, because the stranger coming in, you've got a great status. People will tell you some things that they haven't told anybody in the family before. They haven't dared to. They're often dead now, the people that they hadn't dared tell it to, so that they really like telling it to you.
In this next section, Steve talks about how he recruits interviewees for TV oral history interviews, how this has changed over time, and his most memorable interviewee. The discussion ends with some more advice from Steve for oral historians thinking about using video.
Well, the origins of finding somebody to film used to be brilliantly easy. It's much more difficult now. The way we used to get most of our interviewees was in letters columns of local newspapers. Mm. Every local regional newspaper had them, and the older generation, and we were making most of our programmes on the older generation then, would respond to it. And we would get unbelievable numbers. We adapted our letter and would put it out to say 200 newspapers, all of whom would print it. We get tons of letters, and we'd select them from what looks like the most interesting, the ones that illustrate the points we want to make in the programme. Obviously, we're starting off with our thesis of what we want to do, then we adapt it to what we find. You know, we've sold an idea for a programme to a broadcaster, so we've sold a kind of a thesis. We can change it up to a point. So we're asking, say, for example, if it was about school strikes, we put a letter in every newspaper across Britain saying, do you remember being in a school strike against the cane or whatever it was? We get the response. Then the research process is a researcher either calls them up or goes to see them. We take it to the next stage. Then we discuss that. Then we go back to film them. So the people that we're filming are pretty good in the sense of they're going to work in a television programme. We think they're going to be fairly confident in front of the camera. Or if they're very shy, but they've got a great story, we think, you know, we'll be able to get that story and kind of make them feel at ease and trust us. So that's the kind of process that we go through.
And that's changed now that the letter...
Right. Yeah, we've got to try. It's really interesting now, Facebook, which has got a lot of older people. We do get people through Facebook. We still try the letters columns, but get far fewer through that. We go on local radio, autobiographies, you know, anything that's out there, we get it. But we've got some of our best people just by going to community groups like bingo halls. There's some great women in Do Bingo. One of our best interviewees ever, a woman called Rose Townsend, we found in a Bristol bingo hall. And just the best storyteller who had the most moving stories. Basically, she came from an impoverished part of Bristol, a council estate called Southmead, which had a terrible reputation from the word go. Was bombed out in the Blitz, lived in caves for a year and a half with her young family, but was madly in love with her husband and remained, I can't remember what he did, but I used her. I've made quite a few programmes on love and sex, basically, because audiences watch it and people of that generation were breaking taboos by telling the story, so that was kind of like of interest. She told me this extraordinary story about her first orgasm, which for a woman of that generation, she was talking about the late 20s. It was amazing. And her sex life is really interesting, what's written about sexuality, working class women, all those things. Very, very little is known. But she had the most incredible sex life with her husband imaginable. And it was just brilliant to hear because so few people of that generation would ever talk about it. So I've got like... on that bit, I've got 20 minutes of Rose talking about her sex life in the 1920s and 50s. That's just a strange example of the random things that you get through these people. We also got her how she survived in the Second World War in another programme. Pig's head was the favourite dish, so she described... In fact, we got her to do it in her kitchen to prepare a pig's head and how you could feed a whole family on it. Anyway, endless things like that you get.
One of the things you said earlier, Steve, was a kind of criticism of oral historians for relying on the audio, which we are currently doing right now, which is quite nice. How many people are involved in the process of doing a good oral history video? in terms of, because I would imagine you would need more than just the interviewer, because you need someone working the camera and making sure everyone's okay. And then that kind of leads into questions of the feasibility for academics and for community groups, and that's perhaps where that kind of dialogue between audio, because I can take the recorder, go and interview somewhere, I'm in full control of it. It's not that there's a camera behind
me. Absolutely.
So can you talk a bit more about that process and maybe some of the costs that would be involved in that?
I think that for community groups, audio sometimes works best for all the reasons that you say. It's kind of more cost effective. You can do it with one person. I don't think that everybody should do video history. When I started off making really low budget television programs, where we only had, I made something for company was then called HTV, which broadcast in Bristol, and we could only afford one filming day per programme. But it was possible. I did 16 interviews in each day, and it was in my mother-in-law's house. We had a plain background, and all the interviewees sat together. They had a really good time in one room, and we filmed them in another, and generally I did it for like, I knew in advance roughly what their best story was, 15 to 20 minutes on each. We made a great film out of that. And it is possible to do.
I suppose also the technology is changing so quickly now that we're probably in the transition phase where the video is going to become increasingly accessible. I mean, one of the interviews I've done recently, we're talking about going back and doing a kind of walking interview with them, and we're thinking about ways to film that, and I've been wondering about just getting a GoPro, and you know, the quality wouldn't be amazing, but it would probably be enough for what we want for it.
But I mean, GoPro pictures are used on television a lot, and we've used GoPros, so all those things are possible and can work really, really well. Simple documentary sequences can really add another dimension to it, and they're not that difficult to do. Just shots of someone sat down, big close-ups on their eyes, making a cup of tea, the most basic documentary shots can really add another dimension to it. If you watch most documentaries, the kind of shots that they're getting are really simple. They're just shot on quite a good camera. If someone's got a great story, you're really interested in it, and those shots help you edit their story. That's one great thing about them. And with personal photos, it's not difficult to make 5 or 10 minute doc with a sit down interview, personal photos, a few documentary shots. If they're good, that can be brilliant. But what I do think is that well-funded projects, not just television, should do video histories. I think there's been a real bias against it. I think you do really need two people, ideally, to do video history properly. Somebody to operate the camera and somebody to do the interview. Now, that's not beyond quite a lot of community projects, but I don't think all of them. I'm not suggesting everyone should do video history all the time. I just think it's been neglected, and it's got a kind of a bad press almost, in the sense that it's assumed that people might be intimidated by it in some way, the interviewee. I think it's got far more potential than has been realised. And oral history has gone down this audio-only track, which I think is a real mistake. And I think there's lots of myth about video history and old people being frightened about it, and it's incredibly complicated. I think it's easier to do than most people imagine. But I think there is a place for audios. Why I think it is possible to do video history is one of the clips that I'm going to show later, if I get a chance, is that 3 years ago, I did this video history project with the BFI and the BBC as a spin-off from our BBC Two series, Britain's Greatest Generation. And I taught a group of 10-year-old junior school children to make a video history film. And we show them part of the making of it in this programme, which actually got shortlisted for a children's BAFTA. I was really pleased about it because we got children from schools in the end all over Britain doing it and filming with World War II veterans, and they're really good, some of the films. It was an absolutely brilliant interviewer. I got them from the local school in this village where I live near Bristol. They were 10 and 11 year olds, and there was this girl who was a brilliant interviewer, and she did an interview with this World War II veteran, Fergus Ancorn. He was a prisoner of war camp in Japan. I taught them a bit about how to do it before. I taught them the simple rule when they're talking about a difficult, painful experience, say to them, how did you feel about that? A 10-year-old can understand that. And and they got really good responses.
This has been a podcast for the Newcastle Oral History Unit. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. And remember, you can contact us via email at oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk and on Twitter, where we're @oralhistory_NCL.